From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
At the heart of these riots are France's post-colonial and migration policy and the failure of the Republic to deliver liberty, fraternity and equality to migrants and their children, that is to all members of the society.
France declares a state of emergency after a two-week uprising of immigrant youths. We'll take a look at the roots of the civil unrest. Then veteran war correspondent Robert Fisk of the London Independent joins us to talk about Algeria, Iraq, and the history of the Middle East. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The French government has officially declared a state of emergency as rioting continues for a 13th day. Under emergency laws, the government can implement curfews, carry out house searches, and ban public meetings. Clashes continued around the country. Tuesday in the Bordeaux suburbs, a bus exploded after being hit with a Molotov cocktail. In Lyon, the city's public transit system was closed down after a Molotov cocktail was thrown at a train station. Police say the situation has calmed down in the suburb of Clichy-sous-Bois, where the rioting began. The rioting is widely attributed to disaffected youths in the country's North African communities, where unemployment and poverty are rampant. The Wall Street Journal reports a recent study at the French Academy, the Sorbonne, found a job applicant with a French-sounding name is over five times more likely to receive a job interview than an applicant with the same qualifications but a North African-sounding name. The French Prime Minister said the country faces a moment of truth over its ability to integrate minority groups, saying, quote, the effectiveness of our integration model is in question. We'll have more on the riots in France in a few minutes. The death toll from last month's South Asian earthquake is now estimated to be over 87,000. This according to a Pakistani government official. Meanwhile, the UN said it's received only $85 million of the $550 million it's requested so far. The coordinator of the UN's relief efforts said survivors in Kashmir would, quote, freeze to death if they don't get assistance in weeks. This is one resident of Pakistan's Lower Kagan Valley. A week after the Washington Post reported the existence of a secret CIA-run prison in Eastern Europe, Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and House Speaker Dennis Hastert have called on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees to convene a joint investigation into who leaked the information. The CIA has notified the Justice Department classified information was leaked in the disclosure of the prisons. This could set the stage for a possible criminal inquiry, similar to the one launched following the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reports Republican Senator Trent Lott said senators from his own party might be responsible for the leak. Lott said the secret prison facilities were discussed at a Republican luncheon on Capitol Hill one day before the Post published its report, November 2nd. Vice President Cheney was among those in attendance. Lott said, quote, information that was said in there, given out in there, did get into the newspaper. I don't know where else it came from. It looked to me that at least one of those reports came right out of that room, Lott said. The CIA's inspector general has warned the agency its interrogation procedures could violate the International Convention Against Torture. This, according to the New York Times. In a report, the inspector general said cruel, inhuman, or degrading techniques used in secret locations around the world could expose agents to legal liability. These techniques include waterboarding, in which the detainee undergoes the experience of drowning. The White House is currently pushing a congressional amendment that would exempt CIA agents from a Senate ban on torture for interrogations conducted overseas. In other intelligence news, a CIA official appears to have disclosed the agency's budget, long a national secret. At an intelligence conference in San Antonio last week, Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Collection Mary Margaret Graham said the annual intelligence budget was $44 billion. For the second time in 3 weeks, a defense lawyer in the trial of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and other former regime officials has been assassinated. Adam Mohammed al-Zubaydi was killed instantly when gunmen shot his car in the Baghdad suburb of Adil. Another lawyer suffered serious injuries and was taken to a U.S. military hospital. Members of Saddam Hussein's defense team renewed calls to move the trial out of Iraq. The Iraqi Bar Association says it will maintain a boycott of the trial it announced after Hussein lawyer Sadun al-Janabi was killed October 20th, just 36 hours after he'd appeared at open proceedings. In other Iraq news, the UN Security Council voted unanimously Tuesday to extend the mandate of U.S.-led military forces by 1 year. There are nearly 180,000 foreign troops currently in Iraq. The Boston Globe is reporting the Bush administration has cut off nearly all contact with the Syrian government in an attempt to weaken and isolate President Bashar Assad's government. The U.S. has halted high-level diplomatic meetings, limited military coordination on the Iraqi border, and ended discussions to reform Syrian banking laws to block terrorist financing. The Globe reports the United States also declined a Syrian proposal to revive intelligence cooperation. The Bush administration has repeatedly accused Syria of lending support to foreign insurgents allegedly entering Iraq from Syrian territory and supporting Palestinian militant groups in the occupied territories in Lebanon. U.S. officials told the Globe the Bush administration continues to debate whether to pursue regime change in the country. In the United States, elections were held around the country Tuesday. In New York, billionaire Mayor Mike Bloomberg was reelected over Democratic challenger Fernando Ferrer by a margin of 20%. The New York race marked the most expensive non-presidential campaign in American history. Bloomberg spent up to $100 million on his reelection, 10 times the amount spent by his opponent. Democrats took both gubernatorial races in New Jersey. Democratic Senator John Corzine beat Republican businessman Doug Forrester with 53% of the vote. In Virginia, Lieutenant Governor Tim Kaine beat the Republican Jerry Kilgore, despite last-minute campaigning by President Bush for Kilgore. Voters around the country also dealt with ballot initiatives. In Texas, voters passed a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. In California, voters dealt a major blow to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, rejecting all four of the ballot measures he proposed. The measures included lengthening the amount of required experience before a teacher can receive tenure, requiring unions to hold votes before their dues can be used for political purposes. And for the 14th consecutive year, the UN General Assembly has cast a near unanimous vote calling on the United States to end its four-decade-old embargo against Cuba. The vote passed with a record 184 countries in favor. Only the United States, Israel, Palau, and the Marshall Islands voted against it. United States envoy to the UN, Ronald Goddard, said, quote, "If the people of Cuba are jobless, hungry, or lack medical care, as Castro admits, it's because of his economic mismanagement." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The French government has declared a state of emergency in response to the youth-led uprising that began nearly 2 weeks ago. Under the emergency laws, the government can implement curfews, carry out house searches, and ban public meetings. The French newspaper Le Monde criticized the government's decision to invoke laws that were originally drawn up 50 years ago to quell the independence movement in the former French colony of Algeria. The paper's editors wrote, quote, "Exhuming a 1955 law sends to the youth of the suburbs a message of astonishing brutality, that after 50 years, France intends to treat them exactly as it did their grandparents." One of the last blanket curfews in Paris was imposed solely on Algerians in 1961. This led to mass protests and a severe crackdown by the French police. On October 17, 1961, police killed as many as 200 pro-independence Algerians in what's now known as the Paris Massacre. Police were accused of throwing Algerian demonstrators into the River Seine after they were beaten unconscious. Over the past 2 weeks, the police have not resorted to such force, but there have been mass arrests. Since the uprising began, police have detained more than 1,500 people, many of them of Arab or African descent. In recent days, over 300 towns and cities have been affected by the unrest, including the Belgian city of Brussels and the German city of Berlin. On Tuesday night, youths threw firebombs at police and set cars ablaze in the French city of Toulouse, just as the Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, was visiting the area. Over the past 2 weeks, an estimated 6,000 cars have been set ablaze. To talk about the latest in France, we're joined by three guests. On the phone from Paris is Julia Wright. She's coordinator of the International Committee in Solidarity with Mia Boujamal and political prisoners in Paris. She's the daughter of the renowned writer Richard Wright, who authored the classic Native Son, also about alienation and about racism. On the phone with us also is Naima Boutelja. She is a French-born journalist of North African descent who's written about the French uprising for The Guardian of London. We will go first to you, Nadja. Can you explain to us what you understand at this point? Nadja, are you with us?
Are you speaking about me, Naima?
Yes, Naima, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's the whole unrest is really a reflection of years and decades, even of very heavy social discrimination and exclusion, and a very heavy as well impunity as regard to racism, and impunity as regard to very scornful statement and even racist statement from the French intelligence, the French establishment.
Can you talk about the communities and where the immigrants or the immigrants' children are from that are now in this uprising?
Yeah, I think it's mainly led by, I don't know how much you know about the ethnic minorities in France, but in these suburbs you have mainly, you have to first visualize them. It's a huge concentration of tower blocks. I mean, I live now in the UK and we haven't got anything like that, even if you have ethnic ghettos as well here, but it's nothing comparable to over there. So you have this huge concentration of tower blocks, very often in the margin of big cities such as Paris, Toulouse, Marseille, and with a very heavy concentration of French from North African background and from also Sub-Sahara. And you have also, of course, the minority of French from working class, white French. And the riots have been led mainly or have been involving French from second and third or even fourth generation. So people who are who were born in France, who very often haven't got much link with the countries of their parents, and who are treated and ghettoized as second class citizens.
Julia Wright, from your perspective in Paris, can you talk about what is happening right now?
Well, I had a very eerie feeling of déjà vu, and you'll forgive me, Amy, for being haunted by the first page of Black Boy, my father wrote. When at 4 years old he felt left out, and they were poor, and he was hungry, and nobody was paying attention to his brother and him, and he wandered listlessly about the room, and he stood before the shimmering embers, fascinated by the quivering coals. And a new idea of a game grew and took root in his mind. Why not throw something into the fire and watch it burn? And then why not burn the curtains? And then when the adults realize the house is on fire, he hides under the house. And what really struck me when I reread these pages a few moments ago was, yes, the house was on fire, but I was determined not to leave my place of safety. And I've been working, Amy, with the youth of the suburbs who are now in this state of unrest. And there was an incident on the 27th of October that sparked this accumulation of so-called riots, I don't like the word riots, anger anyway. And I just have to tell you about this anecdote. Two kids were walking a little late, okay. Maybe they had some weed in their pocket. Maybe they didn't, but they were the wrong color and they were the wrong age. And they were seen by two policemen in helmets, what we called garde mobile, and with their plexiglass shield and their whatever you call it, the electric whatever, and like prodding cattle, you know. And these kids, like, it was like in a video game. They just ran. That was their reflex. And they climbed the fence, and they didn't look at the notice on the fence. And there they were in the middle of a high-power voltage electric generator, and they were electrocuted to death. Nothing was left of them. And this was the spark, and it's so telling to us who still have the death penalty in the United States and, in fact, the electric chair. Well, these two kids had no chairs to burn on. And I still feel eerie because as I work with youth, 20 days before that happened, I asked one of the youths who's very gifted to write a statement on how he felt. Could I read the first five lines of that statement?
Yes, go ahead.
I am 20 years old and I don't want to survive here. From death row to the prison of Abu Ghraib, from Baghdad to New Orleans, from Chicago's South Side to the French Hood. Here, over there where you are, chaos. We're no political spinners. We're just voices live from the street where we live, where we become wise, where we are duty-bound to take control. Out of respect for those who are prevented from setting foot in it. That very street I visualize without paved stones. This is a 20-year-old. He wrote this on the 1st of October. The two kids burned to death on the 28th of October. And the suburbs have been burning since.
Jewel, you're right. American activist who lives in Paris, also daughter of Richard Wright, author of Black Boy, Native Son, and other books. Naima Boutelja, a French-born journalist of North African descent, also with us, a researcher with the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Naima, you make a comparison in the piece that you wrote, Explosion in the Suburbs, of the curfew that has been imposed now and the one that was composed in the one that was imposed in 1961.
Yeah, I think just would like to come back a bit on what my friend was saying earlier. I think there is indeed a very, very deep anger amongst my fellow citizens in France who live in the suburbs. And I mean, there is one thing which all the time happened. On the night of the death of these two kids, Nicolas Sarkozy said, tell to everyone, to their family, that they were involved in a burglary, which was after that we know just a lie. And that also 3 days after the death of these people.
That was the interior minister.
So Nicolas Sarkozy, who is the French minister of interior. And 3 days after the horrible tragedy, there was a police who exploded a tear gas inside the mosque. And again, they first deny that it happened and then lied bluntly about, didn't accept to apologize to the Muslim community, which is just a common sense. So all the time, this kind of things happen, this kind of incident happen, this kind of death in the hands of the police. You have like kind of, it's the answer of the government is scornful and completely provocative. So as regard to the imposition of the curfew, which is now in the power of the local authorities, they can impose it in certain areas in their town. It has a very, very legacy, colonial legacy, because the last time it happened in France, it was in 1961, and it just ended up to another tragedy. You had the FLN, which was the main resistance political forces during the War of Independence in Algeria, who called for a peaceful demonstration. And this peaceful demonstration was bluntly and very violently repressed by the police, and hundreds of people died in France, in Paris, on that night, on the 17th October 1961. And until very, very recently, there was no acknowledgement. There's still no acknowledgement at all by the establishment, by the French establishment, about this, what happened on that day. But there was even not knowledge about, even in the anti-racist movement, no knowledge about that day, that event. And again, I mean, that's not going to be to bring peace in the suburbs. That like kind of that is clearly saying to these people that the way the indigenous in the Republic were treated by the French government is very much still alive, and it's very much a way that the government is seeing these French citizens from first and from second and third generation. But the government hasn't only done that, has been saying that, this law, imposing curfew, there is also power from the local authorities, again, to ban any public meetings if they think that it's a threat to law and order, to close any public spaces if they think that they're going to stop the police to make their work. And it's also it's clearly saying that there will be censorship on certain articles on the press if they think that that's also can inflame the situation. So, and again, these kind of laws of this kind of exceptional laws has been imposed during the colonial period, and were not imposed, for example, in 1968 when there was a big uprising and unrest as well, social unrest from the left. So that's just a pretty appalling situation, really.
Naima Boutelja, I want to thank you for being with us, French-born journalist of North African descent, researcher at Transnational Institute, as well as Julia Wright, who is an American activist who's lived in Paris for many years, who heads up the International Committee in Solidarity with Mumia Abu-Jamal and Political Prisoners in Paris, daughter of the renowned African-American writer Richard Wright. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll speak with a man who has lived in various immigrant communities around Europe for 2 years, telling the stories of Muslim migrants on the journey west, an account of a modern-day underground railroad that stretches from Istanbul to Paris, from London to New York City. We'll also be speaking with the renowned war correspondent Robert Fisk about the history of Algerian independence and how it ties into the uprising in France today. Stay with us.
Paris, je te fais la gueule ce soir. Je suis rentré à pied sans être même agressé dans le noir. Chaque fois je t'ai jeté un regard, tu m'ignorais complètement, t'avais les yeux autre part.
serai pas déçu. Suffit que je sois complètement convaincu.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations. And we're broadcasting on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're podcasting video and audio at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the uprising in France and whether it will extend beyond the borders throughout Europe or beyond. We're joined in our studio right now in New York by Behzad Yahmayan. He is an Iranian-born author, professor living in the United States, the author of the new book Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West. We welcome you to Democracy Now! You teach at Ramapo College in New Jersey, but you have spent several years in the immigrant communities from Turkey to Paris. Can you talk about your understanding of what's happening and this latest news of the expansion of the uprising to Brussels, to Berlin?
Yes. I mean, in my opinion, at the heart of the riots in France are France's post-colonial and migration policy and the failure of the Republic to deliver to the public liberty, fraternity, and equality. But the similar problems exist across Europe, actually. There is a migration crisis in Europe that has been growing extensively in the past few years. And sooner or later, there is a potential and possibility of same types of riots and uprisings occur in different places. In France, what we have been seeing is a combination of class, ethnicity, race, and religion and cultural dimensions that gave rise to the riots that we have seen now. Of course, the comments by the Interior Minister ignited the riots, but there were deep-rooted causes that brought about the continuation of the riots. The alienation of the youth. France has continued to look at the post-colonial subjects as colonial subjects, that is, migrants from Algeria and other parts of Africa that were controlled by France are still considered as non-French, although they carry French documents. And that is reflected in the way they are treated economically, socially, and politically. And in the past few years, in France, in the past 10 years, and in other parts of Europe, perhaps less, there has been a religious component added to that, that is Islam, and the association of every Muslim man with potential terrorism. That is, to be a person carrying an Arabic name and being a Muslim, you're automatically a potential terrorist. And that suspicion and fear is not only a fear and suspicion that is ignited by the authorities, but also by the media and by the public at large.
And what about the communities, the elders in the communities holding peace marches, issuing fatwas against the uprising?
The elders, in my opinion, the elders in the community are tired. Their time is over. What matters is the young people, 17, 18, 20, they have the whole future ahead of them. And what they have seen is the impossibility of living under these post-colonial subjective conditions. So they want to make a point. In fact, what is happening, the riots are a cry to be heard. They want to be heard. They want to tell the world that they exist and what their conditions are. In the past 10, 15 years, there has been no way for them to be heard. They're using this to echo their voice, to tell that they want a difference. They want to become French. They are French, but they want to be treated as French. They want not to be discriminated because of being Muslim. That is, they don't want their Islam and the religion to be used as a pretext for discrimination. And in many ways, stigmatization that is very hurtful. to be picked up by the police, to be harassed by the police, to be looked at by the public in a very different way, in a suspicious way.
What about the areas beyond France?
Yes, I believe there is a high potential for the spread of this type of rebellion and rioting in other parts of the of Europe. Let's take a look at one country, for example, that has not actually had any riots in the past few years, Spain. Spain has had a very serious problem with African migrants that entered the country illegally. You probably saw in the media that in the beginning of October, there were riots in the two French enclaves in Morocco. A number of sub-Saharan Africans who were camping on the woods and in the hills around the two enclaves were trying to barge in and actually enter the enclave. The enclaves are separated from Morocco by two 10-foot fences, razor wire fences. So in the attack, 10 people were killed in two incidents, and there are reports that two of the people were killed by the Spanish soldiers and by the Moroccan soldiers. In response to that, the Spanish government has brought warships to the area and has planned to build a third fence. Put yourself in the position of being fenced out in that manner. Within Spain, there are a number of Africans that live illegally. What they do is this: when they enter Spain, they throw away their documents. And since they have no nationality, Spain cannot deport them. They're there, they're illegal, they cannot get jobs, they live in clandestine conditions, and many of them actually have to adhere to petty crime. They sell drugs, they pickpocket, and they are a ripe population for revolt. And incidents in France may give them an example of how they could be heard. They want to become documented. They want to have citizenship to be able to work. That is why many of them actually were on the road for a number of years and risked their lives in order to get to Spain. Their conditions in Spain are not better than what they were in their country of origin. So you have that situation there. You have similar situations, probably not as severe, in Italy. There's a large number of Muslims and Africans living clandestinely in Italy, going from one place to another looking for jobs. But they're being treated very viciously by the police, very suspiciously by the public, and they're not able to sustain themselves. That also is a prime population ready to revolt at any moment. So I really see, unless European Union changes its attitude towards migration, and unless it comes up with a new policy towards migrants, and Muslim migrants in particular, there is no possibility of averting the uprisings in other parts of Europe.
We are also joined by Robert Fisk in our studio. As the civil unrest in France enters its 14th day, we want to look back at that critical moment in French history that's still being felt today, the country's colonial rule of the North African nation of Algeria. To talk about the French rule of Algeria and the country's war of independence, we're joined by British journalist Robert Fisk. He has been the Middle East correspondent for various papers, most recently over the years, the London Independent, for about 30 years. He's based in Beirut, Lebanon, and has written a new book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. And in it, you spend many, many pages on Algeria.
Many bloody pages. Amy, yes, that's right, yeah. I mean, it's impossible to see the crisis in Algeria today, the crisis in France today, without going back to the War of Independence, which lasted from between 1954 and 1962, which eventually gave Algeria not freedom in the democratic sense, but freedom from imperialism, from colonialism. And you've got to realize that the wounds of that war were never healed. The Algerians who fought for the French, the Harki, were never forgiven by the Algerian government or people. The Pieds-Noirs, the vast number of French colonial people who lived in Algeria, who regarded it as their home, whose parents and grandparents were born there. By the way, you keep calling it a French colony. The French, of course, regarded it as France Métropolitaine. It was part of metropolitan France, but the Algerian natives, quote-unquote, didn't have equal rights. The Pieds-Noirs have never forgiven the Algerians for throwing them out, effectively, of the country. And one of the things we're not actually talking about now, but which we should be, is that many of the areas where this violence is taking place around Paris and other large French cities are areas where lower middle class French people who were Pieds-Noirs from Algeria now live. So what we actually have is we have Algerian youths setting fire to cars outside the homes of the people who were expelled from Algeria in 62. You need to realize that it is in this sense there's a civil conflict going on here, not just a minority objecting to their treatment by the country, which is supposed to be their country now, of their citizenship. And what happened, of course, during that war was that the wounds were never healed, since no one wanted to heal them. What we had was a French government that first of all said, we will never leave Algeria, it's part of France, then negotiated with those who wanted freedom, and then, having done this negotiation, effectively ratted on their own French citizens and let them leave in penury and squalor on ships back to France, where in many cases they had no family and no friends. So, in a sense, this is a continuation, and we need to remember that these infamous murders, which is what they were, by the French security authorities in 1961, were carried out when the head of the French police, the Paris police, was in fact a man who had served the Germans loyally under Vichy, who had assisted in the deportation of French Jews to Auschwitz, and who later was imprisoned for war crimes. This is another element which has now been forgotten of this 1961 massacre.
Explain that.
Well, I've just done it, Amy. What we have is that during the period of the 60s, a large number of French officials had served loyally under the Vichy regime, which was set up under the Germans as part of their agreement of the surrender of France in 1940 after the German invasion of France. And until the Vichy regime was effectively taken down in 1944, the large number of bureaucrats who served under the Vichy government of Pétain, Philippe Pétain, who was a hero of the First World War and became the great anti-hero of the Second World War, they continued in office, so that many of the French police chiefs at the time of the 61 massacres in Paris were ex-Vichy officials who had deported Jews to the concentration camps.
And then you have people like the fierce rightist anti-immigrant Jean-Marie Le Pen, who actually...
He's getting boring. It's his daughter you want to watch. But anyway, carry on, yes.
But didn't he serve in Algeria?
So did President Chirac, and won medals for his service in Algeria, as General Ariel Sharon, now Prime Minister of Israel, constantly points out to President Chirac. Most of the French, older French leaders, or most of the old statesmen of France, did have a role in the Algerian War. What's interesting about France is that the French government's attitude towards war is quite different from the British or American, because unlike the US administration, and the titchy little administration of our own dear Mr. Blair, many French politicians served in Algeria and have seen war, which the Bush administration has either not done or chosen not to do, and which the Blair administration is too young to have done. So you do have in France a great fear of war and violence. Mr. Sarkozy, I believe, has not seen war, which is why he's prepared to use these disgusting phrases like scum, translated into English, about the rioters, when quite clearly there are major problems here that need to be addressed, and calling people scum only overheats these problems. I think Mr. Sarkozy will be thrown to the wolves, by the way, because French governments always give in to violence, without exception, always. And I think Mr. Sarkozy will be set out to be put out to dry and forgotten because of this.
Behzad Yahmaïn, before we go to break, your final comment on that connection between the older generation of the French leadership and the young immigrants who are rising up today, many whose parents are, if they are not themselves, from Algeria.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a continuity in terms of the way both generations are treated. The young generation, as Robert was actually explaining, sees itself very correctly in the guise of what happened to their grandparents. That it's the same colonial policies, it's the same attitude towards the subjects that are now being repeated now. The heavy-handed policy by the police, and that is reflected in the anger that the young people actually feel and the frustration that they have. And that's actually one of the main reasons for these riots.
Interestingly, the parents, the grandparents who were part of the resistance in Algeria, now telling their grandchildren or their children to calm down.
It is always the case. I mean, my experience with the case of Iran, those who participated in revolt against the Shah are now have become very conservative, and they're telling their children actually to be careful about their lives and to step down and not to do much. So the older generation actually has become tired. It is the new generation that has to fight for the future. They need to live in France.
Well, Behzad Yahmaïn, I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll have
thank you
back again to continue this discussion. His new book, Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West, and we will continue with Robert Fisk, Fisk, author now of The Great War for Civilization. One of the things Robert Fisk talks about in his book in talking about Algeria is this famous film, The Battle of Algiers. We want to go to a section of that film and compare it to something right here in the United States. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman as we turn now to a film that's been called one of the most influential political films in history, The Battle of Algiers. It was released in 1966 by Italian filmmaker Guido Pontecorvo. The film vividly depicts the Algerian struggle for independence against the French occupation in the 1950s. It recreates the brutal conflict between native Algerians and French colonists in which the two sides exchange acts of intensifying violence leading to the introduction of French paratroopers to root out the Algerian National Liberation Front, known as the FLN. Paratroops are shown employing torture, intimidation, and murder to defeat the resistance. The Battle of Algiers was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, but the film was banned in France for many years following its release. In 2003, the film again made news after the Pentagon offered a screening just months after the U.S. declared war against Iraq officially over. A flyer for the screening stated the following: "How to win a battle against terrorism and lose the war of ideas. Children shoot soldiers at point-blank range. Women plant bombs in cafes. Soon the entire Arab population builds to a mad fervor. Sound familiar? The French have a plan. It succeeds tactically but fails strategically. To understand why, come to a rare showing of this film." Again, that at the Pentagon. Now parallels are being drawn between the French use of torture in the film and the U.S. abuse of prisoners in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. This is an excerpt of the Battle of Algiers. This is a scene of a press conference where the Algerian resistance fighter, Benem Hidi, is answering questions from reporters.
Bon, allez, les photographes, terminé.
Monsieur Benem Hidi.
Mr. Benem Hidi, isn't it a filthy thing to use women's baskets to carry explosives for killing people?
Doesn't it seem even filthier to drop napalm bombs on defenseless villages, wreaking even greater havoc? It would be better if we too had planes. Give me the bombers and you can have the baskets.
Mr. Benem Hidi, in your opinion, does the FLN still have some chance of defeating the French army?
Il demande, Monsieur Benem Hidi, selon vous, le FLN a-t-il encore quelque chance de battre l'armée française?
Selon moi, le FLN. The FLN has more possibility of beating the French forces than they have of stopping history.
One of the Algerians brought before news conference in a scene from the Battle of Algiers. Now, this is another scene a little later in the movie with the colonel from the French paratroopers holding a news conference with reporters.
Colonel Mathieu.
Colonel Mathieu, the spokesman of the resident minister Morland states that Benem Hidi hung himself in his cell, tearing up his shirt to make a rope, which he tied to the bars at a window. In an earlier statement, That same spokesman said that because the prisoner said he would escape on the first possible occasion, it was thought advisable to keep him permanently bound hand and foot. According to you, Colonel, is a man in this condition capable of ripping up his shirt, making a rope, and tying it to the window bars?
You should ask the spokesman about that. I didn't make the statements. For my part, I appreciated Benhamidi's moral strength, intelligence, and the way he stuck to his ideals. And so, even though I recognize that he was dangerous, I pay homage to his memory.
Colonel, there's been talk recently of the Paris successes and of the methods they said to use. Could you say something on this?
The successes result from these methods. The one presupposes the other.
I feel that being an excessively careful, my colleagues keep asking roundabout questions, to which you can only reply in a roundabout way. It would be better to call a spade a spade. If it's torture, let's speak of torture.
I understand. You have no questions?
The questions have been asked. We would like the answers.
Let us be exact. The word torture does not appear in our orders. We ask questions as in any police operation against an unknown gang. The FLN asks its members to keep silent for 24 hours if they are captured. Then they can talk. That's the time required to render any information useless. How should we question suspects? Like the courts, and take a few months over it? The legal way has its drawbacks. Is it legal to blow up public places? When he asked Benhamidi, what did he say? Believe me, it's a vicious circle. We could talk for hours without reaching a conclusion. The problem is quite different. The FLN wants to kick us out of Algeria, and we want to stay. Even though we have different ideas, I think we all want to stay. When the rebellion started, there were no nuances. All the papers, even those of the left, wanted it suffocated. We're here for that. We are neither mad nor sadists. They call us fascists. They forget what we did in the resistance. They say Nazis, but some of us survived Buchenwald. We are soldiers. Our duty is to win. Thus, to be quite clear, I'll ask you a question myself. Must France stay in Algeria? If the answer is still yes, you must accept all that this entails.
A scene from the film The Battle of Algiers. We're now going to turn to a news conference at the White House yesterday, where Press Secretary Scott McClellan was questioned by veteran reporter Helen Thomas.
Is the administration asking for an exemption?
I am answering your question. The president has made it very clear that we are going to do... No, you don't want the American people to hear what the facts are, Helen. And I'm going to tell them the facts.
Every day I'm asking you, yes or no, did we ask for an exemption?
And let me respond. You've had your opportunity to ask the question. Now I'm going to respond to it. And I'm going to answer it, just like the president. I just did. And the president has answered it numerous times. Our most important responsibility is to protect the American people. We are engaged in a global war against Islamic radicals who are intent on spreading a hateful ideology and intent on killing innocent men, women, and children. We are going to do what is necessary to protect the American people. We are also going to do so in a way that adheres to our laws and to our values. We have made that very clear. The president directed everybody within this government that we do not engage in torture. We will not torture. He made that very clear. Helen, we will continue to work with the Congress on the issue that you brought up. The way you characterize it, that we're asking for exemption for torture, is just flat out false, because there are laws that are on the books that prohibit the use of torture, and we adhere to those laws.
For an exemption, is that right? I mean, be simple.
I just answered your question.
What are we asking for?
The president answered it last week.
What are we asking for?
Would you characterize what
we're asking to do? What is necessary to protect the American people in a way that is consistent with our laws and our treaty obligations, and that's what we do.
Why does the CIA need an exemption from the military?
David, let's talk about people that you're talking about who have been brought to justice and captured. You're talking about people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, people like Abu Zubaydah. No, this is facts about what you're talking about.
Why does the CIA need an exemption from rules that would govern the conduct of our military and interrogation practices?
There are already laws and rules that are on the books, and we follow those laws and rules. What we need to make sure is that we are able to carry out the war on terrorism as effectively as possible. Not only to protect Americans from an attack, but to prevent an attack from happening in the first place. And you bet.
Yes, that was an excerpt of a news conference, this one not fictional, yesterday at the White House, the questioning of Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary. The exemption that Helen Thomas and other reporters were asking about is the one that the Vice President, Dick Cheney, has requested. Senator McCain of Arizona, who was a POW in Vietnam, sponsored a bill that would say that no prisoner held by the United States can be treated cruelly or inhumanely. And Vice President Dick Cheney has lobbied him personally to make an exemption for the CIA. We turn now to Robert Fisk, author of The Great War for Civilization, longtime veteran war correspondent. Your response from Algeria to the White House.
Well, a colonel in the U.S. Special Forces said to a good friend of mine a few months ago, in a telephone conversation, you know, torture works. I quoted him on my book just before it went to press, without giving his name, though I know who he is and I know what his job is. Torture is used routinely by U.S. forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It is a fact. One of the amazing things was that when I went back to research my book, I found that by the summer of 2003, I was doing interviews with Iraqis who clearly had been tortured, but the only evidence was their own word for it. We were printing my reports in the paper, but they didn't get on the front page because, of course, there was no substantial confirmation from any other source except their own words. But quite clearly, different people who had no contact with each other were reporting the same treatment. One of the initial torture implements was bottled water, plastic bottles filled with water, which they would beat a prisoner, particularly American troops based just outside Ramadi and Fallujah in a big base. It was actually run by the 82nd Airborne. And the interrogators would beat the prisoner with the plastic bottle filled with water until it broke, and they would continue beating him. So many of the men actually had sharp cuts from the broken plastic on their face when the water had broken out. And I found approximately 7 men of quite different origin in different cities all gave the same description of these beatings. They couldn't have made this up. This was not a complot, as the French would say. It wasn't a plot. It was obviously real. And it was interesting that when, in fact, the pictures first came out of Abu Ghraib, of the atrocious abuse of people, sexual abuse, the initial reaction was, oh, my God, what will the Iraqis say? Well, the Iraqis knew all about it. They weren't at all surprised. It was we, the Westerners, who were shocked. What? We're doing this? And it was very interesting to see that when under the various pieces of legislation by which you can, and we in Britain can't, get hold of documentation of Abu Ghraib, when more pictures were about to be revealed, which, oddly enough, I think they have not been, the response of the U.S. government was that it would create further anger among the Iraqi population against U.S. troops serving in Iraq. It won't. The Iraqis know all about it. They're not shocked at all. They think that's how we behave, and actually they're right, aren't they?
What do you make of President Bush in Panama saying, we do not torture?
It's not true. I'm afraid that most armies torture in one way or another. The British engaged in torture in Northern Ireland, and they certainly did in Aden, South Yemen, as it then was. I'm pretty sure we did in Cyprus. I've got considerable evidence, which I can't prove, but it's fairly substantial, that torture was used against Egyptian prisoners during the 1956 Suez invasion. The French army actually massacred Egyptian prisoners, particularly fishermen, in a subsidiary of the Nile and the Suez Canal. I'm afraid armies perform like that, especially when they're losing.
And the Vice President of the United States now asking for an exemption for CIA officers, for CIA agents engaged in torture of Republican Senator McCain, who was tortured.
Well, this
POW
obviously
in
this assumes that it's rather more easy to be tortured by the CIA than by the military, or the CIA find it rather more easy to torture, which I'm sure they do. Well, they could take some, you know, lessons from the KGB as well, who are also becoming our friends now since the Soviet Union collapsed. Look, at the end of the day, you've got to realize that even if we don't do the tortures, we are using this system, laughingly known as rendition, where we put our would-be torture victims onto an aeroplane and send them back to a country where they will be tortured, but we won't actually put the electricity onto their genitals or their penis in order to make them scream with pain. These aircraft are flying through Europe. In fact, they're flying through Shannon Airport. I was giving a lecture in Ireland the other day, and I said, why don't the Irish police go on board these aircraft and unshackle these men and take them off in the interests of law and order? Because what we've got to now with the torture is that we are becoming the criminals. We are the criminals now. And if we're going to behave the same way as the Taliban would behave, and they would not hesitate to put electricity onto people's bodies for torture, then the war is over. It's finished. We have no further moral cause to fight for.
What do you make of the Washington Post exposing secret CIA prison in Eastern Europe?
Yes, they won't say, but they wouldn't say where they were, would they? In fact, the prisons are about 100 miles from Warsaw in Poland, and also quite a considerable way from Bucharest, but in Romania. It was very amusing to find that the Washington Post would not say that Poland and Romania were the two countries involved, and most American journalists have fought shy of saying that. But Poland and Romania are the two democracies where these people are taken for torture by the CIA.
And what do you make of them complying with the Pentagon request not to name the countries?
Well, this is the same problem that's existed all along with American journalism, and that is this osmotic, parasitic relationship between the press or journalists in general and power, where to criticize your country's foreign policy, especially when it's at war, is seen as a form of unpatriotic behavior and thus of potential subversion. Add to this the sort of American school of journalism where everyone has to have 50% of each story, each side, which is ridiculous. The victims should be the subject of the story if we have any kind of compassion at all as human beings. When we reach this stage, I think journalism ceases to perform its function. What we should be doing is challenging authority, which is what Helen was trying to do in that clip we just saw from the White House press conference. But if you want to see the normal White House press conference, you'll quickly see the relationship between the journalist and the president. It'll be, Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President, and then George W. Bush say, John, Amy, Bob, whoever it might be, right? That is the relationship that exists now. And it should be much more combative. You know, Amira Haas, the very fine Israeli journalist, a friend of mine, we were discussing the purpose of being a foreign correspondent about 2 years or so ago. And I was going on about, you know, we write the first pages of history in my Brit way. And she said, no, Robert, our job is to monitor the centers of power. And we don't do that.
Robert Fisk is our guest. This is part one of our interview. Stay tuned for part two. The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, is his book. He has been reporting in the Middle East for some 30 years, based in Beirut, going back and forth to Baghdad, to Afghanistan. Afghanistan almost killed by an angry mob after the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, reporting on Algeria and Lebanon, occupied territories, Israel and Palestine. That does it for this part of our discussion. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there for our daily headlines, transcript, video, and audio of our broadcast. We podcast at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!